We're recording now.
Okay.
If you could say your name and your role.
I'm Charles Clark. I'm the Member of Parliament for Norwich South. I've twice in my life been a minister in the Education Department, including being Secretary of State for Education.
Was history the sort of subject you enjoyed at school?
Very much indeed. I did history A-level, and I did history up through the school. To such an extent did I enjoy it that the school had to change its curriculum to allow me to take it. My strongest subject was actually maths, but I wanted to take two maths and history, which wasn't one of their the combinations which they normally did. But they did enable me to do that, so I did history A-level, and I very much enjoyed history.
Good. How important do you think it is in the school curriculum?
Extremely important. I don't think anybody can form a rounded view about society today or about many of the issues that we have to deal with in society today without at least having some concept of history and the historical framework which has led us to where we are. In fact, I would argue that a lack of historical perspective is a serious problem in a lot of contemporary debate. And I think that the more history is studied, the better.
In terms of contemporary debate, which debate do you think...
Well, if you take an excellent example is the current question of the development of the European Union, countries in the European Union, and the evolution of democracy in various countries at different paces and at different times, where there's a kind of instantaneous belief that all countries should simultaneously go through the political and democratic evolution that we did over a period of, what, say, 400 years, and say, well, suddenly you get to a new point and off you go. Well, anybody with a sense of history looks at our own history has to appreciate that the forms of society, or the form of society which has emerged now, has emerged over a long period of time, and to expect other societies somehow to compress this into a very short time scale, I think, is unhistorical and misleading about what should happen.
That seems to point to a preference for doing that particular issue in the school history curriculum. Would you say that it's important to understand the development of democracy? That there are certain issues one ought to have.
I certainly would. I don't know if you're going to ask about it later on, but one of the key issues for politicians and ministers is the question of who does determine the curriculum, and for all kinds of reasons, actually historical reasons about the fear of totalitarianism, we've created a system which explicitly excludes the ability of ministers to be able to determine the curriculum, and history is a classic case. And you can see in other countries, Japan for example, areas where political engagement in trying to determine what history is taught is potentially very dangerous. But I do have a view, for example, that the way the history of Germany is taught in 2009 in British schools, with its focus on Nazism, is not the best way for us to look at the history of Germany and the dominance of the Nazi period. And I had many discussions with the German ambassador when he was here about this very point. And so you learn effectively nothing about the unification of Germany, and a great deal about the war. Now, there are good reasons for that in the understanding of the knowledge, the searing experience of the war that people have in households, and that people talk about their experience, which can bring children into history. But actually, it's a very unbalanced way of looking at a particular aspect of history. I'm only saying German history, but you could say it about many different examples.
I mean, it points to a problem of choosing what should be the content of the curriculum.
It's a deep problem, and it's a major question. The fact that some subjects recur, the Tudors are another case. But personally, I well understand why. It's a very exciting period of history. Is not necessarily the best way of looking at history.
Just coming to your period in office at the Department of Education, were there any urgent issues relating to the school curriculum when you took over from Estelle Morris in 2002?
Well, there are a number of questions, but my central approach, which I think is different to what went ahead and has not been followed since, is I felt the way to improve teaching was through subject specialisations. I believed, and I continue to believe, that it's extraordinary that government gives so little attention to the actual content of education at all. So if you take teachers, for example, teachers become teachers, A, because they enjoy teaching, but B, because they enjoy the subject which they're teaching. I'm talking at secondary level here now. So what do we do to encourage history teachers to enjoy history, to encourage math teachers to enjoy maths, and so on? Or to take a different dimension of the same thing, how do we examine the way in which information and communications technology can help teachers teach, whiteboards and so on, which is different in the way it can help people teach in different subjects? The way in which you can use technology to help teach history is different to the way in which you use technology to help teach science, biology, for example. But we don't think about this enough, and we don't support enough. And so I was trying to establish partnerships with the subject associations that were involved, which the largest is the Association of Science Education, to try and get a support for professional teachers to be able to be engaged more in their subject as well as in teaching. Now, to that end, I took personal responsibility, because history is a subject which I enjoyed very much on history, to say, well, what could we do in this area? And I brought together various of the people involved in history to try and discuss what needed to be done.
And that's how you came to have the meetings that I've learnt about with people at School's History Project.
They were exactly, and I mean, what I did, it was difficult to find the right group, but we got people like the School's History Project, like the editor of the BBC History programme, like some of the people who ran the Stately Homes, the National Trust and so on, because actually they can be a very practical means of leading people towards studying history. Like my old history teacher, Alan Palmer, who taught me history and was the editor of the Dictionary of Modern History, Penguin Dictionary of Modern History, and he wrote a number of historical novels, but I just asked him, because he taught me history, because I thought it would be interesting to see what he said. And we had some very interesting discussions, and I think it changed things a little bit. What I was trying to get at was what the people who knew about it thought were the problems about the way history was taught in schools, and what could we do to encourage it, and what needed to be done. And we had two or three interesting discussions, I thought.
There weren't any specific initiatives then launched from that discussion?
There were odd things. There were odd publications. One of my arguments was, and is actually, that parents want to help their children to learn but don't know how, and there's a complete dislocate between the school system and the family, so that, for example, if parents take their children to, I don't know, a fort on Hadrian's Wall, how does that relate to the way in which the Romans are being taught in school? So we talked about there were some specific publications about how to help that kind of interpretation, so parents could help their children learn in a way that helped them at school as well. We had some competitions on museums, to encourage museums and give bits of funding to help them develop their relationship with schools. Again, the issue was the school visit is different from the parents taking their children to see the museum, and how do you support that? But there weren't specific initiatives in terms of the actual curriculum, because not that I recall, I need to double check the history. Jessica Asato, do you know Jessica Asato? She did some work, she's trying to do some work to promote history in education. She's had a look at the archive on that. She's the director of the think tank Progress now. She did some stuff. I'm not quite sure what she's done, but she could probably tell you. But I don't think there was anything specifically. I mean, there's a massive and bureaucratic process of review of the national curriculum, which takes place in its own way, and trying to intervene in that is difficult. And we didn't see history as a crisis area in the same way that we saw maths as a crisis area. We did see maths as a real crisis area for what needed to be done. History, it was less that. There was a sense of dissatisfaction about what we were doing, rather than a sense of crisis.
Set against that, you made a controversial statement about medieval history in 2003, and I'm sure you're aware of it, suggesting the funding for universities should be directed to subjects which were obviously useful to the economy. So would you place the study of the past sort of in the non-useful category, or just some of it, given what you've said?
Well, I didn't say that, and it's a correlation of two separate things, which was extremely irritating. I did a speech at Worcester, at the University of Worcester, about the role of modern universities, which was designed to, it was during the period before our white paper on higher education, in which I said that I thought that you couldn't divorce university education from ideas of utility. And what I actually said was that the medieval concept of the university, i.e. the community of scholars, could be justified as a basis for some support for universities, but wasn't the basis, in my view, for the overall funding of universities which came from the British state, because there's an enormous range of different arguments as to why higher education should be funded, of which the medieval concept of the community of scholars was only one, and a relatively minor one, actually. And that got it reported somewhere. There was some journalist in the room, as me criticising medieval history. And it was extremely irritating. The best response I had to it was my the Vice-Chancellor of UEA, David Eastwood, who's now the Vice-Chancellor of Birmingham, was interviewing for professorships of medieval history a couple of days after, and asked about this. And people were obviously shocked by my being so negative about medieval history, allegedly. And he said the answer he was looking for is check your sources. And in history, of course, checking your sources at that level ought to be what you do. And but that became round my neck. The second thing happened. I did an interview with somebody on the Sunday Times in which I made the remark, which I defend, that the argument that you study subjects for their own sake is an argument that's quite difficult to make. You need to make an argument around utility in general. Now, if you then say, do I believe that the study of the past has a utility, I believe it has an immense, enormous utility, and I think it's ridiculous to suggest that it doesn't have a utility, and I think only very narrow concepts, which I don't have, of what is useful, say that only certain subjects should be studied. I specifically do not believe that study of the the arts, of literature, of history does not have a utility. On the contrary, I believe they have enormous utility for the society. And it's those who say that, who identify the utility argument with things like engineering and science, which I don't, who then say, oh, he doesn't care about those subjects. But I think that's their problem rather than mine on the whole issue. So the quote is not an accurate quote. The history of it, I've told you. As I say, I found it constantly irritating as it constantly gets recycled. But in answer to your actual question, I strongly believe that the study of all history, including medieval history, has an enormous utility.
In terms of informing the general public or encouraging teachers? And
informing the whole society. I mean, I've just, the other day, we've got a dig, it's pre-medieval, of the Roman camp just outside Norwich, where the Romans, after the defeat of Boadicea, allegedly put down their fort, and they started excavating it again. I went to have a look. And, you know, this has tremendous utility in all kinds of different ways. It's pre-medieval, but or to take the silver discovery recently in Staffordshire, the idea this is not useful to society in some way, I find a complete abuse of the word use. But I think there are a whole chunk of people who believe that utility and usefulness is very narrowly attached to some particular economic immediate benefit, on a very short-term benefit. Well, that's not my view. I in fact think the cultured societies are ones which value their study of their history and so on. It's actually in the cultured societies that the greatest evolution of society happens. So I don't see the issue in that way.
Some people will say that actually public history is in a healthy state because there is a terrific interest in it, but that it seems disconnected from school history.
Well, that's exactly why I brought the group together. I mean, if you look at the BBC History magazine, it sells very well. If you look at the people who visit stately homes, millions of people go to them, or, you know, walls on Forts on Adrian's Wall or whatever. There's a great difference. You look at people's study of their own personal family history and the immense business that's now establishing that. People have an enormous interest in their history. But it's a classic problem of schools that they are often very distant from what's going on in the real world, and that's the criticism of schools at all. And I mean, that's why I argue that the school teachers in particular should be engaged with what's happening more generally, and I think that that's the only way to go. And I think there is a serious danger of a very scholastic approach to the teaching of history in schools, which doesn't relate more widely. But any time anybody proposes any change in the curriculum to deal with that, you immediately get a number of defenders of what I would describe as a very narrow academic tradition in terms of the study of history, who say, well, you can't make any changes in this because of that. And it's an area which is almost outside any public debate. I mean, there's a kind of very inadequate discussion about these things.
I mean, to what extent should concerns more broadly about national identity or ethnic or social diversity affect the history taught in schools?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the history of migration. The CRE, the Commission for Racial Equality, as it then was, did a very interesting project, I suppose, 12 years ago, on how migration made up a society, going right back, of course, for thousands of years. And it's, I think it's very, very important to try and describe how our societies have been formed through diversity in a variety of different ways. And you then talk about, and in fact I think it's completely blind not to see that that will continue and indeed accelerate. The idea that we kind of reach some spot where we say, okay, here it is, here's England, stop, is complete madness in my opinion. And apart from I think being very unpleasant, I think that there's a lot of joy in the change that happens. But of course you then have to go back to, well, what is the nation and what is the nation state and all the discussions about nation state. And of course the Victorian period, I suppose you'd know better than I, you're a better historian, but the Victorian period created a concept of nation, probably more than what had gone before, I don't know, which has absolutely dominated the way we think about it today. The century of nation building at that time, the nationalisms throughout Europe were about some concept of nation being there, which had took with it some concept of race and other issues that were established. But I'd say now, meaning for the last 10, 15, more than that probably, or 30 or 40 years, that is dissolving in a variety of
Britain, it's dissolving.
Well, just the concept of nation is fantastically challenged, both by devolution at one level, but also by the patterns of migration at the other level, and the nature of what is this country, where we now are. You only have to look at the classic sporting expressions, the national football teams, the cultural expressions, the food, the eating. You know, there's what we eat today is fundamentally different to what we ate 50 years ago, and that is an expression of the nation, if you see what I mean, which has changed.
That presents two problems for history teachers. In one way, what to present in terms of a national narrative, and in another way, how on earth to fit all the different perspectives that are available into a history of the United Kingdom.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I'm not sure that I think, I've thought about this, but I don't have an answer to it. I'm not at all sure that the concept of a national narrative is meaningful. There are various, quotes unquote, national narratives, which certain historians use to try and describe the evolution of the nation in different forms. But I'm not convinced that there is something that I would call the national narrative. I could reinvent a national narrative, I could create one. I could say, here's a Charles Clark version of a national narrative, which is different to the Winston Churchill version of a national narrative in his books, or whatever. But I'm not sure how valuable that is as a concept. And therefore, if I doubt that, which I do, then the question of how do you fit these various traditions in, I don't think is particularly helpful. And I would say it's probably ahistorical to try and squeeze a set of different versions into a national narrative, which may be a rather artificial construct in any case.
But then that brings me to the question of whether there should be a national curriculum then in history.
Well, I think there's a basic level of knowledge about what our history has been, which is quite important for as many people as possible to have some mastery of. And you can argue that there are different ways of looking at, for example, the Victorian period, and that it would be wrong to say it should be this way of looking at it. I see that. On the other hand, The reason why the national curriculum was formed by Margaret Thatcher's government and Ken Baker and all those in the mid-80s was because actually there were so many different versions of history being taught, and not only for the slightly technical problem of people moving around the country a lot and redoing it, but generally there were whole swathes which were completely ignored. Now, if you have total confidence in the capacity of history teachers, which I don't, then you'd say you don't need any kind of national framework for it to be taught. But actually, I think it is reasonable that every child should have some level of understanding of history across a wide range of different areas, and the existence of a national curriculum helps that to happen. Now, you could argue, and in fact I would argue, that the national curriculum is often a very restrictive framework for the way of looking at things, and I think you could make a pretty strong case for more professional freedom to address issues in history, if I can put it like that. But I don't really believe the national curriculum was ever, it was criticised for this, but I don't think fairly, was ever conceived of as an ideologically correct version of history being driven into every school. I know that's how it's presented by some people, but I don't think that's what it was. I think it was conceived of as the view that history ought to be, the whole sweep of history, ought to be taught to all students.
Many teachers today that we've been talking to have suggested that in fact there's a massive squeeze on time, which means that quite a lot of young people are not being taught very much history.
Well, I partially accept this. It's a running argument with the teaching profession. They say if you focus on English, maths, science, everything else gets squeezed out. Well, they do say that, and that may not be what they're saying to you.
They say more than that. They're saying also about the introduction of a skills-based curriculum which doesn't have differentiated subject areas, which seems to be a new trend as well.
Well, I'm just a bit of a sceptic about this. I know teachers feel put upon by the evil state in this area. But I don't really accept it. I think it's entirely possible. In fact, the example I made earlier about technology and also visits to great historical places are absolutely techniques which can and should be used to go beyond this. And I just am out of sympathy with that level of argument. I don't really accept it at all. When I look at my children at school or just at a regular school or whatever, and when I talk to other people's children, I don't get a sense of this. I think it's part of the teacher's view of the world that everybody's out to get them.
So you're completely happy with the amount of time that's allocated to history, geography?
Well, completely happy is a strong word. Essentially, you've always got a contest for time in the school curriculum. Do I think that English or maths or science should be downgraded in terms of amount of time? Well, I don't really, actually. Do I think more could be done on history and geography? Well, I do. Well, then people say, well, what are you trying to squeeze a quart into a pint pot? To which I then get into discussions about how long's the school day and how are we going, what's going on, and what other activities are around in the extended school to be able to see both subjects like history and geography being extended. I also think there's some extremely positive and exciting projects where history and geography are allied with subjects like maths, English and science, which are quite interesting from that point of view, where they can work together. And I think actually teaching some basic subjects through history and geography can be quite positive. But it's this, I suppose what I don't like, and I'm sounding like an old, real old foggy, but what I don't like is the what I think is a highly precious view that history is our subject and you can't deal with it with anything else. We've got to have our time, and that's how it is. I don't accept that, not only for history, but also for other subjects as well.
I suppose, on the one hand, you're saying you want subject teachers who are very enthusiastic about their subject.
Mm.
On the other hand, you want teachers who are not precious about other people teaching their subject.
I do. But I don't think... So. I mean, I know you're pointing to a contradiction that may be true, but I don't really accept the contradiction. Nor do I accept that if I look at many people, myself included, at school that it was impossible to study history, for example, there, and do the other subjects as well. And I just don't quite accept it.
So, in your view, should subjects ever be subordinated to the learning of skills, or do you think that it's always possible to marry the two?
Well, I do, actually. I don't. I think skills are important, and skills include the ability to analyse, the ability to articulate, the ability to present arguments, and I think they're all pretty important. And I think children should emerge from school possessing a range of different skills.
Academic skills or personal skills?
Both. I mean, you can argue what the balance is. I mean, I for example, am not against teaching people to drive more at school, for example. Or do first aid. And if people came out of school equipped to be first aiders, I don't see that as a bad thing. And as I say, I think I don't understand why there should be a competition between so-called academic skills and so-called personal skills, except for a preciousness about the word academic, which I'm not sympathetic to, and a possible argument about time, but I really am pretty sceptical about the time argument. The ability to present yourself and write a letter, write an essay, whatever it might be, that overlaps pretty strongly with academic skills. And why not?
Just finally, education is widely seen by politicians as one of the major agents of change in society. What implications does that have for the curriculum, and in particular for the teaching of history?
I think that's a very interesting concept. You're quite right, and of course you're quite right. It has been seen, particularly on the centre-left, has been seen as an absolutely great driving force. Why has it been seen as a great driving force? It is because in a world which is changing increasingly rapidly and will continue changing increasingly rapidly, the ability of an individual, for that matter even an organisation, to understand the process of change and then deal with it, whether to respond to it or whether to control it, is an absolute key requirement for the education system to ensure that people are able to do that. This was, in fact, the key argument I made at the University of Worcester speech that I was referring to earlier. And what it'll be judged by, what education will be judged by, is the extent to which it does equip people, the society as a whole, to deal with this process of change. Now, that requires individuals to be given the wherewithal to understand what's happening. I would say history is very important in that, by the way, and the skills, to going back to that, to be able to deal with that process of change. And that's where I think education will be judged. Now, what does that mean for the curriculum? It means that the curriculum will have to reflect that capacity. But why historians should see that as a threat, I've got no idea. I mean, in fact, I think the reverse is true. I think that understanding the movement from time zero to time three is something which is history and which is precisely about the process of change.
Thank you very much. I don't think I've got any further questions.
Fine. I hope I'm not too rude about you.